Today on Against the Grain, what did 60s radicals in Europe want? Were the uprisings primarily political in nature? And how did revolutionary movements in Western Europe compare with those in the Eastern Bloc? I'm CS. Timothy Scott Brown discusses his new book, 60s Europe, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. They were volatile, turbulent, liberatory, revolutionary years. Uprisings, rebellions, challenges to the status quo were legion. People organized, demonstrated, and expressed themselves in all sorts of ways, some of them unprecedented. How do we make sense of the 60s? What propelled 60s radicals? What did they believe? What did they want? How did they understand history and the world around them? Timothy Scott Brown has been investigating these sorts of questions for years, with a focus on how the 60s unfolded and exploded in Europe. Timothy Scott Brown is professor of history at Northeastern University. His books include West Germany and the Global 60s and Weimar Radicals. His new book is 60s Europe. It's published by Cambridge University Press. Today's program features two things: a talk that Tim prepared about his book and its main arguments, and my interview with the author. We begin with Tim's talk.
60s Europe is a book about the political and cultural rebellion of 1968. Now, that rebellion didn't happen just in the year 1968. It got started in the early 1960s, and it continued well into the 1970s. Sometimes we use the term long 1960s to capture this greater period of time. And so 1968, which sometimes one puts in quotes, or the 60s, are really just convenient shorthand terms. And what are they shorthand terms for? They're shorthand terms for a period, a revolutionary moment, if you will, marked by not just one rebellion, but a series of rebellions, a series of interlocking rebellions. In the West, this is very strongly a rebellion against capitalism. I'll come to what it represents in the East Bloc presently. Everywhere, it was a rebellion against imperialism and colonialism, against cultural strictures, in favor of new modes of artistic and personal expression, against racism, restrictive gender roles, sexual repression, and so on. The uprisings in Europe and America were nested within a broader anti-colonial rebellion, forging kind of a link between the First World and the Third World. And I should note that the term Third World was extensively used at the time. It was the term of use at that time. So it's a term we continue to use, even though Global South is our new modern usage. But the Third World was a political category promoted within the Third World at that time and adopted in the West. So it's the term we often use when talking about the 60s context. So this is all one reason why it's now a truism in the scholarship that 1968 represents a coming together of the global and the local. We talk about many locals and the way in which they're connected and become part of a global event. And another reason for that is that this period of time was marked by a new and unprecedented movement of people, ideas, and images across national borders. I mean, activists traveled around and met each other, leading intellectuals traveled around, met with students. It was very easy to see imagery on TV of rebellions taking place elsewhere, horrible images of the Vietnam War, the images of the Buddhist monks' self-immolation in Vietnam, or Nick Ut's famous photograph of the aftermath of the napalm attack in Vietnam. Those sort of images were everywhere, widely spread by new possibilities of mass media. So this is one of the characteristic features of the 60s, this movement of people, ideas, and images across borders. And when we think of the 60s, we often think of big events in the West, such as the Berkeley Free Speech Movement, the occupation of Columbia University, both in the United States, the rebellion of May 1968 in France, university occupations in West Germany, Italy, and elsewhere in Western Europe. We also often think of the Prague Spring, the push for a humanist socialism in Czechoslovakia that was destroyed by the Warsaw Pact invasion in August 1968. And it's not as well known that the Prague Spring was only one of the more visible rebellions in the East Bloc. And really something that a lot of people have gotten wrong that I want to correct is that it's often thought, or it's often been said since 1989, since the fall of communism, that these earlier rebellions against Soviet misrule in Eastern Europe around 1968 were just sort of attempts to join the West. That is, that rebels in the Prague Spring or in Poland or East Germany or elsewhere in the East Bloc were really just searching for the benefits of liberal democracy and capitalism, and that they really wanted to kick the Soviets out so that they could have, you know, better consumer goods, TV sets or whatever. And I really try to show in my work that this is a false reading. Nothing's really further from the truth. I demonstrate that these rebels in the East were really largely fighting for a new, improved socialism. They took the socialist project seriously. They understood that it had gone down a bad path, an authoritarian path, but they did not want to throw out the socialist baby with the authoritarian bathwater. And they really wanted to get rid of the repression associated with Stalinism and replace it with democratic self-management by workers and by students from below. So in other words, they wanted to replace it with participatory democracy. And participatory democracy, of course, is one of the main key concepts of 1968 in the West, the idea that people in all walks of life, I mean, definitely, you know, in this context, students, but also workers, but everyone really should take an active hand in the conditions of their existence, should participate in making democracy rather than just, you know, in America, for example, voting every 4 years or every 2 years for representatives who would then go off and do whatever they wanted without necessarily having any regard for the will of the voters, but rather a much more thoroughgoing democratization of the face of daily life that would determine conditions of work, conditions of education, conditions of living. And in the East, you know, this very much involves the idea of socialist democracy, right? A kind of socialism that is thoroughly democratic from top to bottom. And this was the goal of many radicals in the West as well. And so I think this is one of the key things that the rebellion has in common and on both sides of the Iron Curtain. And so this is really relates to the first of five main points I want to emphasize. And the first point is that I try to write across the East-West divide in a new way. I'm not happy with the idea that we have to think about Western Europe in one way and we have to think about Eastern Europe in another way when there's a rebellion taking place on both sides of the Iron Curtain, using many of the same ideas and with many of the same historical and theoretical touchstones. So I think here that we have to take, first of all, we have to take seriously the fact that people in the East were developing an understanding of the socialist project that was emancipatory, that they were trying to rejuvenate socialism from below, that they believed in socialism and they wanted to create a better socialism, a socialism that lived up to its promise and wasn't just a cover for an authoritarian police state. And so in that context, we have to understand that 1968 in the East is really an attempt to find a way forward to socialism and not an attempt to escape into liberal democracy and re-embrace capitalism. The second point has to do with the intersection in the 1960s between politics and culture. Around 1968, there was a lot of talk of cultural revolution. We're gonna make a cultural revolution, and one of the valences of that, of course, is connected with the cultural revolution in China, capital C, capital R. But there was a number of understandings of what cultural revolution meant, and a key feature of the 60s is that this idea of a cultural revolution was inseparable from ideas of political revolution. So that meant that the political rebellion was intimately connected to the rebellion of lifestyle on the one hand, and on the other, to the rebellion in the arts. So I spent a lot of time examining how these multiple rebellions influenced and synergized each other. And I argued that this synergy of the political and the cultural, variously defined, is one of the characteristic features of the 1960s rebellion.
His name is Timothy Scott Brown. He's talking about his new book, 60s Europe, and he is an historian at Northeastern University. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Let's return now to more of Tim's talk.
A third point has to do with a traditional narrative that I wanted to overturn or problematize, and that's the narrative that holds the uprisings of 1968 to be kind of this freestanding thing that came out of nowhere, this sort of turning point that just popped out of nowhere and then disappeared. And I emphasize the opposite of that, really. I try to show how the rebellion of the 60s centered around the crisis year of 1968 has to be situated in the long sweep of revolutionary history. When we think about 1968, we need to see it as one of a series of moments that include, you know, 1789, the French Revolution, 1848, the Europe-wide rebellion revolutions, the multiple revolutions of 1848, the Paris Commune of 1871, the Russian Revolution of 1917, the Spanish Revolution of 1936, the Hungarian Uprising of 1956. And I'll return to why these particular dates are so critically important in the 60s context in a moment. But I argue that in connection with this longer history, we really need to think about how the 60s fits into it. It's not just that, you know, there were some university occupations and there was some overvaluation of the third world, and then we had hippies, and then we had Apple computers and whatever else, and now we have what we have now. It's the 60s are not part of this narrative of they're not part of this coming of age narrative where we get out some youthful enthusiasm or almost destroy society in the conservative telling, almost destroy society and then come back to our senses. It's part of a long history of dealing with the critical issues that affect society and that continue to affect society, issues about how society is going to be organized. And I like to think in terms of a classical, what I call a set of classical revolutionary dilemmas that all revolutionaries over time, across these couple of centuries and through these different revolutionary moments have to deal with. And these are dilemmas that preceded 1968. They stretch back to the French Revolution of 1789, and they remain with us today, I argue. What are some of the dilemmas? Well, they have to do with things like authority, you know, the question of authoritarianism versus anti-authoritarianism. What should be the relationship between leaders and led? Should there be leaders? Should the revolution be top-down or should it be bottom-up? This is connected to a second dilemma about organization versus spontaneity. How important is it to have a revolutionary party or a set of revolutionary cadres? Is that necessary, or is it possible for spontaneous activity to be generated among the people that results in revolutionary change? What's the role of the individual in this? What's the relationship of the individual to the collective? What's the relationship between culture and politics? Should culture take a back seat to politics, or do the revolutions within the realm of culture, do they represent, you know, the more important revolutions. One of the things that 60s politics really revolved around, and this was controversial at the time, was the beginnings of what we refer to as identity politics today, right? The women's rights movement, the gay rights movement, and it was strongly disputed at the time whether those items belonged in the revolutionary agenda alongside things like overthrowing capitalism or defeating colonialism and imperialism. So there's this whole thing about, you know, in the 60s, they talk about the personal and the political. The personal and the political are one, but in fact, even though that was a claim that had a lot of truth to it in terms of the way people approach politics, the relationship between the personal and the political was actually heavily disputed. So these sort of questions go through all the revolutionary moments, and they have to do with the history of socialist movements, stretching especially back to the Russian Revolution, the parties that were launched in the aftermath of that, and the different flavors of the socialist project. And there's a battle in each of these moments between these different understandings of the socialist project. So all these questions were unresolved in 1968, and they remain unresolved today. And this brings me to a fourth main point, which has to do with the content of the radicalism of 1968. And I like to emphasize a particular set of ideas and practices that I think has often been overlooked. We often have heard talk and seen scholarly writing about the adoption of third world models by young people in the West, right? So the key importance of Che Guevara, for example, or of Maoism for Western radicals, you know, and there's a reason why those figures were so influential, and it's because the 60s rebellion takes place in concert with, or in the broad context of, a global rebellion against colonialism that sees a massive wave of decolonization, right? The decolonization that produces this sort of landscape that we know today happens, you know, overwhelmingly in the 1960s. And of course, the Vietnam War was the sort of all-embracing issue on both sides of the Iron Curtain, and also in the Third World and all around the world, which, so, you know, the centrality of the anti-colonial struggle in the 1960s is completely understandable. But I like to emphasize that this is a, you know, it's a contingent thing, right? It's like in this particular moment, that was the guiding reality that shaped revolutionary impulses. And of course, it was extremely influential for radicals in the West, but it didn't take the place of these long-standing issues about the proper organization of society that's bound up with these different revolutionary dilemmas that I mentioned earlier. So I like to highlight these other issues that are sort of the underlying issues that aren't a product of that 60s moment, while obviously giving, you know, due credence to that key defining aspect of the 60s. You know, but focusing on the influences that were not just a product of this particular moment of global anti-imperial struggle. And so these are kind of the evergreen revolutionary questions. So there's a through line in my book, 60s Europe, a sort of golden thread, which has to do with what I see as the core of the socialist project, in which many militants in the 60s saw as the core of the socialist project. And that's participatory democracy and worker self-management. Worker self-management obviously often had a valence of factory workers, right? Like self-organization in the factory using the strike and trade unionism. And it could still mean that, although, you know, industrial production is less important now than it was in the 60s. So worker self-management is really a more philosophical term for people's self-organization from below in whatever context of work that they have, right? Again, connected to the idea of participatory democracy, which is a key 60s idea. But that key 60s idea is really a core idea of the socialist project and a disputed idea going way back, right? So this idea of the direct control of one's life at the point of production and at the point of living, as it were, like a democratization of daily life without the imposition of authoritarian leadership from a self-appointed vanguard. I mean, obviously, for many years, for decades, stretching back into the 20th century, it sounds funny to say stretching back into the previous century, but that's where we are in 2021, that, you know, the Soviet project has a bad name for a number of good reasons, right? And socialism has become, for people on the right and many people sort of in the middle, kind of a word that has negative connotations. But those negative connotations are being shed now very much with the younger generation that's interested again in socialism. And it's important to recognize in that context that there are many meanings and flavors of socialism that were extant even during the Soviet heyday. And that's one of the stories of the 60s and one of the overlooked stories. So, you know, the question of whether, you know, so the Soviets, they pull off a revolution or they, depending on how you want to look at it, the Bolsheviks place themselves at the head of a revolution that overthrows Tsarism. And then they end up imposing a dictatorship that results in a nightmarish system of Stalinism, you know, which inspires Orwell to write 1984, right? So there's a rebellion from the very beginning against the idea that that's what socialism is. And that's sort of one of the strong issues of dispute.
You are listening to Timothy Scott Brown talking about his new book, 60s Europe. Tim is an historian of 20th century transnational social movements, and he is professor of history at Northeastern University. Let's return to more of Tim's talk.
You know, I mentioned key dates earlier, like the French Revolution of 1789, the Europe-wide Revolution of 1848, and, of course, the Russian Revolution of 1917. But I also mentioned the Paris Commune of 1871, the Spanish Revolution of 1936, and the Hungarian Revolution of 1956. And I didn't mention, but could have, the so-called Kronstadt Rebellion of 1921, which was when sailors and workers in the Baltic Sea naval base at Kronstadt rebelled against the Bolsheviks to establish mass socialist democracy and were crushed. And so, you know, in the 60s, your choice of date meant a lot, right? If a militant, and there are many militants who affiliated themselves with, who saw themselves as part of a tradition of anarchism or anarcho-syndicalism, you know, so workers' self-management free of party control. And for those militants, you know, the Paris Commune or the Kronstadt Uprising of 1921, and especially the Spanish Revolution of the 1930s, which is strongly stamped by anarchism and sees workers' cooperatives and collectives, agrarian collectives founded, are extremely important. So there's a way in which 60s radicalism is inflected through choice of source material. Like, is your source material, you know, the Cultural Revolution in China and Maoism, about which not that much was understood actually in 60s Europe at the time? Or is your source material, you know, all the anti-Bolshevik socialist revolutions influenced by anarchism? And it was really interesting to me, there's a new collection of interviews with activists in France that was extremely useful for me in writing the 60s Europe book, in which you could see very much the ideological disputes, you know, which people were influenced by anarchism, which people planted their flag on 1921, 1936, 1956, and which people planted their flag on 1917, right? Or planted their flag on the idea of Maoism as a model for the global revolt. So these dates fired the imagination of 60s radicals, and particularly these dates I emphasize that in which the sort of anarchist side of things was important, because these are moments in which the ghost of social revolution reared its head. And we can differentiate here between a political revolution and a social revolution. So a political revolution being marked by a change in leadership at the top, but a social revolution being marked by a sort of overturning of all conditions, a true revolution of daily life that's marked by participatory democracy. It's from below. So it's there's sort of like this, you know, question of whether the revolution should be top down or bottom up. So these moments, these historical big events are influential for radicals in the 60s because they're moments in which activists, militants tried to establish anti-capitalist democracy. They try in moments in which they tried to combine liberty with equality rather than sacrifice liberty for equality or equality for liberty. So what emerges in my 60s Europe book is a different history of 1968 in Europe, one that traces a different intellectual lineage than the one that usually gets traced through third worldism, Maoism, etc., and one that I think marks out the relevance of the 1960s today in a moment in which, you know, the ongoing decolonization struggles are concluded, but we see, you know, mass immiseration even in the West and something approaching a failed state currently in the United States, right? These questions are very much on the table. And so here, you know, we come to a fifth and final point I want to emphasize, which has to do with the unfinished business of the 1960s. So I mentioned how 60s radicals argued that the personal is political, that how we live, how we experience gender roles, for example, was not a private matter, but a social matter. It's really telling, it's really interesting to me how much, I mean, much of the research I did before this book was about the 60s in West Germany. So I know that the West German case really intimately, and it always was amazing to me, almost shocking, like a mindset from a lost world, how the power of the idea of a collective action, which I feel is something that has been lost a lot at the beginning of the 21st century, although it's being recovered in things like Black Lives Matter, for example. But this idea of collective action, the idea that your problems are not just your own personal problems that you have to solve through sucking it up and working harder, kind of like the neoliberal model, but the idea that your problems are actually social problems that you hold in common with other people and that you could act socially together with other people to make change in your common interest. This is so strongly pronounced in West Germany in the 60s and 70s, but of course it ran through all the 60s rebellions. And you know, another part of this is the idea that activists really sought to educate themselves on their own time about the revolutionary struggles of the past and also to come to grips with uncomfortable legacies, like in West Germany, the history of Nazism, fascism, or in the United States, the history of slavery and racism. 60s radicals worried about, especially about the power of mass media, the power of mass media to confuse people, to hoodwink them, to corrupt their thinking, to lead them onto paths that directly contradicted their own interest. And, you know, looking at our current media landscape, I think that their analysis was very prescient. And it's far worse than they could have even dreamed, I think, currently. 60s activists sought to win equality for women, to fight for gay rights, fight for representation for racial minorities, and to make it possible for people more broadly to unfold their true identities and capabilities. And so they really came to grips through all of this with an old question, and that question is still our question, and that's the question of how to create a society beyond predatory capitalism, a humane society in which human needs are actually met. And so that question now is sharpened, right? It's sharpened by the rise of the radical right around the world, it's sharpened by growing inequality, and it's sharpened by the climate problem, which is an existential crisis. So the question remains, it's really our big question today, and it's all these questions, you know, are a part of each other. You know, in the 60s, they operated on the principle that all struggles are connected. And this is another one of these things that makes me think about something that happened 50 years ago, how different, you know, the mindset could be, right? Almost there needs to be some skeleton key to understand how people thought about this in a way that could seem impossible to think about it now. But there was very much the idea that it was impossible to fight one struggle and leave others untouched, that they were all connected. All the things I've been talking about were all connected. So this idea of a total solution has been lost a bit, but could also come back. But this issue, I think, remains very much on the table.
That's the voice of Timothy Scott Brown talking about his book, 60s Europe. Tim teaches history at Northeastern University. He's currently working on a book entitled The Greening of Cold War Germany, Environmentalism and Social Movements Across the Wall and Beyond, 1968 to 1989. After a short break, we'll present an interview I recently did with Tim about 60s Europe. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Timothy Scott Brown is a professor of history at Northeastern University and a senior fellow at the Institute of European Studies at UC Berkeley. He's the author of a number of books, including West Germany and the Global 60s, The Anti-Authoritarian Revolt, 1962 to 1978, and Weimar Radicals, Nazis and Communists Between Authenticity and Performance. Tim joined me recently to discuss his new book, 60s Europe. You said in your talk that the synergy between cultural and political and artistic rebellions was or is one of the characteristic features of the 60s rebellion. Are you saying that this synergy was unprecedented in the sense that previous rebellions or revolutions did not have equivalent levels of kind of these multiple rebellions influencing and feeding off each other?
Basically, yes. It's not that earlier revolutionary moments didn't involve the arts. It has more to do with spread and velocity and multiple levels of synergy going on. I mean, it's partly because there's so much new that's going on, right? Like there's a moment in the 60s when it's possible to see all that's new going on and feel overwhelmingly like this is a new, qualitatively different moment in which innovations in the arts, the radical politics, the decolonization struggle, youth culture, rock and roll, that all of these things taken together are a new form of multifaceted, all-embracing revolution, right? And it partly has to do with, you know, it's this post-war moment, like all the innovations in the arts that are taking place and the birth of a youth culture. And it is the first time that there's a youth culture of that type, like this sort of freestanding youth culture with the birth of the teenager after 1945, the advent of this succession of youth subcultures and the importance of fashion and music to that. So like that alone feels revolutionary, right? And that alone feels like a huge threat to the status quo, like the length of men's hair or the length of women's skirts. I mean, all of that. And of course, the advent of the pill, right? Like there's basically multiple revolutions taking place. And that's why the moment feels so powerful. And I would argue that that is new, especially if you take into account the way it's all mediated by mass media, the way the spread of people, ideas, and images is enabled by the growth of air travel, for example, things like that, right? So just there are so many new possibilities. There's so much new stuff happening simultaneously that feels to the protagonists, and I would argue is unprecedented.
And quickly, the birth of the teenager, by which you mean what?
Well, the birth of the teenager is the creation of a new category of young person. I mean, there is no such thing as a teenager before the Second World War. You know, the teenager is the new, you know, more urbanized kid who isn't necessarily going to go into the same, you know, rural line of work as their parents, but who is going to have a car, have a little bit of money, have a job, be able to purchase rock and roll records and new fashions. And it's a new life moment that didn't exist before. And it's a life moment that not only can lead to sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but can lead in the 60s to, you know, sort of like easy adoptions of radical jargon or even, you know, political ideas that are very outre, right? So it's just, yeah, it's like a new social category that had not previously existed that creates the conditions for the birth of a freestanding youth culture.
So Tim, in talking about the influence of historical revolutionary precedents to what happened in the 1960s in Europe, you're suggesting that historical consciousness was rather high, that there was a kind of familiarity with history on the part of 60s radicals. Can you talk about that? I mean, we might think about familiarity with history as something that intellectuals are able and willing to do. And of course, students and intellectuals were a big part of 60s uprisings. But of course, there were also workers and other sorts of populations and subpopulations. So to what extent did maybe people who were not intellectuals, who did not like study history in the classroom or write about it or teach it, to what extent did they become and were they able to become familiar with these previous revolutions that then inspired them to think about change and to think about how social movements had accomplished things in the past?
Well, I mean, this is a project of the young intelligentsia primarily, right? So students or people that are near the student scene, but also people who are in the counterculture, maybe who dropped out of college or graduated from college and then became, you know, the European version of hippies or whatever, right? But so for one thing, history is very strongly stamped on the European countries in the 60s because history is a living thing, because if you're in Berlin, there's the Berlin Wall, right? And there's the history of Nazism that isn't talked about that much. And that's one of the things that they try to open up. If you're in Italy, you've got the history of fascism. If you're in the East Bloc, you know, you've got a certain version of the Russian Revolution stamped on the very landscape, right? You've got party rule and its worst variants, you know, shaping your daily life. So it's not like anyone can escape from history or that history isn't ever present. But there's also an attempt to do historiographical work, right? Like it's the idea of historiographical work as a necessary prerequisite for informed revolutionary action. You know, to think, for example, about in West Germany, you know, to cite that example, like, what was the history of Nazism and why don't we talk about it? Why is there a wall in the middle of Berlin and why is Germany partitioned into two states? You know, there's a banner in my previous book on West Germany. There's a banner that some students are holding up in 1968 that has the dates 1848, 1933, 1968. So they just juxtapose these three dates. Well, what happens in these three dates? 1848 there's a continent-wide reaction against the revolutionaries and the imposition of even more, you know, sort of authoritarian regimes across Europe. The revolution's defeated, right? The reaction is victorious. 1933, the Nazis, who rose to power partly as part of a reaction against the German Revolution of 1918, come to power, right? And their first order of business is to put communists and socialists in concentration camps and destroy the trade unions. 1968, the government's debating the so-called emergency laws, which are going to be designed to allow the government to step in and declare martial law if they need to in a future situation of civil unrest. And those laws were in fact passed, right? But this kind of historical connecting the dots, this argument by, I call it argument by analogy, historical or argument by historical analogy, that, you know, just putting the three dates together on a banner is an argument, right? And everyone knows these dates. So it's not like some kind of arcane, you know, research process that has to take place to talk about 1848 or 1933 or 1917 or 1936, for that matter. I mean, some dates are more esoteric than others, right? But I look at this as a broader project on the left of, what characterizes all this left activity in the 60s is self-organization, different concepts of self-organization. So there's also a self-organization of knowledge and a self-organization of media. And the 60s are marked by the proliferation of alternative media, media from below, you know, the creation of little newspapers, leaflets, educational programs, right? So that's where this argument by historical analogy is refracted. I mean, that among other things, right? So it's kind of part of it's driven by avant-gardes, okay? So in that sense, it's an esoteric project, but it's an esoteric project that's driven by common knowledge dates and what they signify, and also reclaiming and recapturing dates that people don't know about, right? So like, for example, if you're an anarchist in the 60s and you disagree with the French Communist Party and its Stalinist leanings and the way it tries to quash, you know, the revolt of 1968, because it's basically a party of the establishment at this point, maybe it's useful for you to think about other times when leftist militants had to oppose communism, right? So you would think naturally of the Kronstadt Uprising of 1921 that was crushed by the Bolsheviks in favor of mass socialist democracy that was crushed. You might think about the Spanish Revolution, where, you know, Stalinist secret agents tried to quash anarchist activity in the rural communes and in Barcelona and the urban milieu as well. You might think about 1956, when the Hungarian rebels rebelled against Stalinism and were crushed. So this is the way that dates function. And again, you know, some dates are more well-known than others, but it's part of a broader project of self-education as a necessary prerequisite for taking correct political action.
My guest is Timothy Scott Brown. He's a professor of history at Northeastern University. His books include West Germany and the Global 60s and Weimar Radicals. We are talking about his new book. It's called 60s Europe. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So one of the chapters in your book, 60s Europe, is called Cultural Revolutions, in the plural. And you go through a number of cultural rebellions that you contend were very influential and significant. And I'd like to ask about one or two of them. One is the beat-influenced thought and music and culture that emerged in the 60s and 70s. I guess the so-called beat wave of the 60s is part of this. Can you give us some specifics about this cultural lineage and the effect it had on young people and perhaps people who weren't so young?
So there's two meanings of beat here. I mean, on the one hand, you know, the influence of the beatniks from the 50s and into the beginning of the 60s is very profound, especially the reception of people like Allen Ginsberg in Europe and Gregory Corso and others and their role in synergizing a new sensibility that could lead into the creation of a counterculture, both in America and in Europe. But the second meaning of beat is a synonym for rock and roll in Europe in the 60s. So the beat wave that I refer to is, it could also be called the rock and roll wave, right? They called it the beat wave. So beat music is what they called the Kinks and the Stones, right? I mean, basically that was what beat music was. So rock and roll, beat music, and the styles and attitudes associated with it was understood in sort of an explicitly revolutionary way by young people in Europe in the 60s. It was understood to be a template, to provide a template for new ways of being, of like sort of the liberated self that might not be explicitly political, but was given a political valence by authorities on both sides of the Iron Curtain. I mean, authorities cracked down on it, and that brought kids into conflict with the authorities that they hadn't personally necessarily sought, right? But like once that moment is revealed, the moment of the truncheon, at the rock concert, it places kids into a new relationship with authority. So, and this happens on both sides of the Cold War divide. So it's really important in that respect. And then also later in the 60s, it becomes explicitly politicized, and there are bands that think of themselves as socialist bands, right? But I think the real point here is that it's all seen by people as part of the same thing. It's largely seen by the protagonists as part of the same thing. And that doesn't mean there aren't people on the left who take a dim eye toward, cultural stuff, right? Like the more Marxist-Leninist types, the more staunch self-described revolutionaries. But in general, the cultural revolution represented by the beat wave and the political activity of fighting in the street or whatever is seen to be part and parcel of the same thing.
Who were the provos?
So the provos are a small group of anarchist militants in Amsterdam who got started in quite early. They're very precocious. They get started in the early mid-60s, and they're extremely influential because they explicitly draw on the anarchist tradition in the Netherlands and elsewhere to posit, sort of anti-Bolshevik form of radical socialist politics. But they do so in the context of youth culture. So the provo, if you look at pictures of the provos, they're like the cool kids, with like mop top haircuts and striped shirts, like looking like, like the quintessential sort of beatnik influenced mid-60s hipster, right? Like they take the youth culture and they fuse it with this devotion to the traditions of anarchist militancy, and they take those two things and they combine them with attempts to purposely provoke the authorities into taking actions that then reveal the nature of authority. So the famous incident when they bomb the royal wedding with smoke bombs, is an example. It causes this big sensation, or they put up an exhibit that the cops then raid and then beat people up, then they take photos of that and create another exhibit that shows that, right? So it's this whole idea of creating situations that reveal the true face of authority. And there's a way in which in the 60s in certain countries in Europe, the door is open to do things that might not have been possible in other moments, right? So like we can think of some of these actions as things that would get one in a lot of trouble in certain countries now, or certainly in the United States, right? Like that would result in jail time or something worse than a beating from the police. But there's a way in which in the 60s at this time, in certain countries at least, it was possible. Like the authorities were strong in certain ways, but they were also in certain ways back on their heels, right? So it was possible to take it to them, to push, to get up in the face of authority with these kind of actions. In West Germany, for example, you know, 20 years before it had been Nazism and the Holocaust, right? So there are certain ways in which the West German government is trying to join the West, you know, trying to be a liberal democracy, right? That eschews brute force, even though they don't always eschew brute force, right? That's another matter. But I see the 60s as in Europe as a moment at which it was possible to do certain things that previously were impossible and later would be impossible. And one of those things is to use tactics of provocation in this way, in a very forceful way. So that's the provos are famous for that, and they become known throughout Europe and even in the States for doing this. And provo groups are founded in other countries, and they become sort of ambassadors for this certain style of cultural political rebellion that's highly influential.
That's Timothy Scott Brown. He's professor of history at Northeastern University, and we've been talking about his new book, 60s Europe. It's published by Cambridge University Press. Tim, congratulations on the book, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, CS.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.